Morning, Seb. Okay, I'd like to introduce Michael Smith, who's going to be talking about GStreamer.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming. A lot of you have probably used GStreamer in one way or another. It's now pretty pervasive through the Linux desktop, particularly GNOME, but there are quite a range of KDE applications that use it as well. So, but the chances are what you've used it for is media playback. A simple audio player, a simple video player. What I want to do is explain a bit about the internals of GStreamer, how it works, how you can write applications with it, what it is, and then demonstrate some of the more advanced things that you can do with GStreamer that you can't easily do with just a player. So let's start with what is GStreamer. It's a multimedia framework. It's a bit similar to things like DirectShow and QuickTime. DirectShow is actually a pretty strong inspiration for the current design of GStreamer. It went through quite a few iterations of design before that. The 010 series of releases was in many ways inspired by DirectShow, but expands and extends upon that. It's primarily developed on Linux, but it runs on OS X, it runs on Windows, it runs on Solaris, it runs on FreeBSD, it runs pretty much anywhere you might want to run. Anywhere that can run a fairly large-scale Linux system. You're not going to put it on something with 64 kilobytes of RAM, but the Nokia N800 and so on, N810, that uses GStreamer as its main media engine. So, what exactly is a multimedia framework? It's not a codec implementation. It doesn't provide you with an MP3 decoder, a Vorbis decoder, or anything like that itself. It's not an actual application. It's not a video player. It's not a video editor. It's a system to write, a set of API and libraries with which you can write your own multimedia application. All of the actual codecs and other codecs, sources, network sources, streaming, reading off a video capture card, all of this is provided by plugins. So you can add any functionality you want just by writing another plugin. It doesn't have to be shipped as part of GStreamer. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't even have to be free software. Although, you know, obviously we would much prefer that it was. As an application developer, the main reason to use something like this is to avoid having to know a lot of details about a specific codec or a specific platform. If what you want to do is read off a sound card and encode it to the user's choice of format, you could do that with GStreamer. Or you could learn ELSA and learn liblame and libvorbis and whatever other, and libfaac. Or you can just use GStreamer and plug everything together, read from ELSA, OSS, direct sound on Windows, core audio on macOS, and encode to whatever formats your users want to, whatever formats your users have plugins for, and avoid having to learn all those low-level platform and codec-specific details. GStreamer isn't the only game in town, in a sense. It's not the only multimedia framework. It's not the only, even on Linux, it's not the only system that you can use for this. So why should you, as application developers, if that's what you are, why should you use GStreamer? We like to think we have good quality documentation. It's not perfect, but we've gone to a lot of effort to make it a lot better than the average open source project, which, as many of you know, sometimes they're a bit lacking in the documentation department. It has what we think is a pretty well-designed API. GStreamer as a project was founded in 1999. It went through about 6 to 7 years of experimentation, new versions, new APIs, and so on, until in about late 2005, we got to the final release of the 010 series, which we found, and other application developers found, was well enough designed, and complete enough to write a huge range of real-world applications. We're also guaranteeing API and ABI stability. As many of you might know, if you try and use something like FFmpeg, you might get something nice running in not very much time at all. But then when you go and run it next week, it stops working because they broke their API or their API. We have in the past broken our API, we have changed our API. Now, we didn't finalize the 0.10 API until late 2005. We have gone to a lot of effort to make sure that it's parallel installable with older versions. For a long time, most Linux systems shipped with both GStreamer 0.8 and 0.10. Within the 0.10 series, we have added lots of API as new releases come along, new features come along, but you can run your application that was written against 0.10.0 and compiled against 0.10.0, and it will work with GStreamer from 2.5 years later. That's been a real goal for us, to provide that stability that for our application developers, to make it a choice that is appropriate for people who want to be able to keep their systems running and not have to rewrite them every 6 months. This is essentially because we had experience with things like FFmpeg, which didn't give you that. The architecture, internally it's very flexible. The plug-in architecture and the way the different parts plug together, which I'll go into in a bit, makes it possible to write a huge range of things. Many early systems from longer ago, although you could write plugins for them, they fit into a very rigid set of roles. For example, you saw many media playback systems of various types where you could write a decoder, you could write a demuxer, you could write a visualization plugin. But if your plugin didn't fit into one of these rigidly designed roles, you just couldn't do it. So GStreamer makes sure that you're able to do whatever you want. Lots of testing. Again, this is part of our focus on quality, part of our focus on making sure that people can rely on our releases and do what they want to do and get the stuff that's underneath there out of the way and just go and write their application. There are also bindings to a lot of languages. GStreamer itself is written in C. The Python bindings are powerful and pretty complete. You can even write plugins in Python. There are also a whole lot of other language bindings. I personally don't have that much experience with them, but they exist. Java, Ruby, Perl. I think there are others as well, but I'm not even sure what some of them are. People go and write their own bindings, use them in their application. Sometimes they don't tell us. Being cross-platform is another big benefit. Most of the other multimedia frameworks are not cross-platform. DirectShow, Windows only. QuickTime, really a Mac OS thing, although they ported it to Windows. Certainly can't use it on Linux. Reels Helix framework is a bit more cross-platform, but is also not something that, in my experience, people actually want to use. It's a big, strong community. There are a lot of contributors. There are contributors who do it as a hobby. There are contributors who are paid to do it. There are big companies using it and feeding stuff back into the open source community. There is commercial support for GStreamer. There are commercial codecs for GStreamer. If you want to go and get an H.264 decoder that you can actually ship with your product that has all the licenses and so on, you can go and buy one. Go ahead. So the question is basically, are other language bindings available on all of these other platforms? There are no well-packaged GStreamer bindings for Windows. They do exist, they do work, but if you wanted to do that, you would probably have to do a bit of that packaging work. But they run there and they've been tested there. It's an LGPL system, but the GStreamer core plugins can be any license. As I said, you can have some of them are GPL, some of them are most of them are LGPL, some of them are proprietary. Some of them are just things that ship on hardware devices that have proprietary licenses that we don't know much about. The N810 comes with plugins for there to do hardware decoding of some video formats. It has a much more clear legal situation than a lot of the alternatives on Linux. Many of the systems such as FFmpeg and the players such as MPlayer and so on, they just give you a dump of code. You can use it, you cannot. It's very difficult to see which of the things have licenses and or are not covered by patents. Patents are a big problem in multimedia. GStreamer very clearly delineates plugins that are freely distributable with those that, you know, you might want to have your lawyers look at this. So now that I've told you why I think you should use GStreamer, let's go on a bit about how GStreamer works. At the top level, GStreamer has what's called a pipeline. The pipeline consists of lots of these lower level things, elements, bins, pads, caps, and so on. I'll get to those in a minute. But you have a media pipeline that flows from a source element, such as a sound card, or a file, and data can flow through the pipeline to some sink. Now, the sink might be a sound card or a file, or it could be something else entirely. So elements are the basic part of GStreamer. Everything that you use in GStreamer is an element. Here are some examples. File source. File source is what we call a source element. It reads a file. Pretty simple. MAD. MAD's an MP3 decoder. So that can take in data from the file source, decode it, and feed it to AlsaSync. A sync element in GStreamer is something that accepts data and consumes it. It doesn't pass it on any further. So you could use these three together to make an MP3 decoder. Of course, often you want to aggregate functionality, so you can put them into bins. I'll get to some examples in a bit of more useful bins, but a bin is a type of GStreamer element that contains other elements. It lets you control the set of elements as a whole simultaneously. There's a special type of bin, and that's the pipeline. So here we have a bin, which is our top-level pipeline, containing our file source, our MP3 decoder, and our audio sync. On the previous slide, we weren't showing any of the pads. Without the pads, you can't do anything with GStreamer. There is no data flow. Data flow doesn't happen between elements per se, it happens between pads. So data comes from the file source through the source pad into a sync pad of the MP3 decoder. From the sync pad of the MP3 decoder, it then comes out the source pad and arrives eventually in a sync element. And a sync element is an element that only has sync pads. So we connect them together. You link the pads together in a series. So now these indicate the data flow. Pads are what data moves along. I'll get to the details in a couple of slides, but a pad is where you both buffers and events travel along pads. Buffers are what contain the actual data. Now, once you have data, you need to be able to describe what it is. It does you no good to just throw a chunk of data from an audio decoder, such as the MP3 decoder, and try and play it back in the audio sync, because without any information about what that data is, how do you know if it's mono, stereo, 22 kilohertz, 44 kilohertz, etc. So data has what we call caps on it to describe what it means. A caps object in GStreamer has a type name. It looks a bit like a MIME type, although, and in some cases, in many cases, they're the same as the MIME types, but it's not, strictly speaking, tied to the MIME system. And then it has a series of name value properties. So here's an example in a textual format that we have for it. The GStreamer libraries can convert to and from this text representation. So we call it audio slash xraw int. That means integer audio. And then we can say what sample rate it is. We can say that it's 16-bit depth audio, and it has two channels. With that information, an audio sync can actually play that back, assuming your hardware supports it. Now, we have a little tool called GST Inspect. GST Inspect lets you look at any of the plugins that the system knows about, and it will print out all the information about it. So it starts with the... I'm inspecting the Vorbis encoder, Vorbisync. It starts with description, authors, and so on. This is actually an element. Not a single plugin often contains many elements. So we print out the information about the element, and then we print out the information about the plugin that it comes from. So what this is here, this says that the Vorbis encoder has a sync pad. A sync pad is one that that data enters the element on, and its capabilities, its caps, are this. It takes in XRAW float audio of a sample rate between 1 and 200,000 hertz. That's probably just an arbitrary limit that someone put in there for no good reason, because it turns out that Vorbis can actually do 250 kilohertz audio. So that's probably a little bug, but not one that people run into on a regular basis. It can support between 1 and 256 channels. It supports little endian data. That's because it's raw floating point. I have an x86 system, which is little endian, and it only supports native endian floats. If I ran this same program on a big endian machine, it would actually print out the opposite endianness. And it supports only 32-bit floats. You can't give it double precision floats. And then the source pad here, the source pad is where the data leaves the element, supports audio slash X Vorbis, that is raw Vorbis data. So the encoder takes in this audio and outputs Vorbis data. There are lots of other things that GST Inspect will show you. So one of the big ones is all the properties. GStreamer is based on glib. Every element in GStreamer is a gobject-based thing. It supports everything you get from gobject. Subclassing, instantiation, properties, and signals. So one of the common properties you might want to set if you are writing an application is the bitrate property on your encoder. And that just works like any other gobject system. One other thing that caps are used for, there are two types of caps. Ones are just like this, unfixed caps that have ranges in them. The other are fixed caps, where you don't have any ranges. So if you feed audio data into a Vorbis encoder, it has to have fixed caps. It has to say exactly what sample rate the audio is. It has to say how many channels it has. But the Vorbis encoder can use the cap system to describe the whole range of things that it can accept. And elements can negotiate between themselves on what formats to use. So one common example is, let's say we have a, well, let's go a little bit away from Vorbis Inc. and have a look at Vorbis Deck. You'll see up the top there, Audio XRAW Float. Vorbis Deck also outputs floating point audio. Most sound hardware only supports integer audio. And so you need to be able to convert between the two. There are elements that can do that. In the case of audio, it's an element called audio convert. But audio convert, you don't want it to have to do that extra work if it doesn't have to. So if you did have hardware that supported floating point audio, and such hardware exists, then audio convert would see that the input is in one format, that the next element in the pipeline, downstream in the pipeline, supports the same format, and it wouldn't convert. So the negotiation system allows elements to query up and downstream to see what possible formats are supported by the elements. Very briefly, auto plugin. This lets you figure out what components to use, what elements to use. If I try and play an Ogg Theora video, what a player would do is it uses what are called type finders. And there are type finders for pretty much every format any of us have ever heard of, every multimedia format that any of us have ever heard of. And they will go through and actually look at the file, figure out what format it is. Then you go and look in what we call the registry, which lists all of the plugins, lists all of the elements in each plugin that we have. And so you can go through that and find an element that says, oh, I support Ogg. And then the Ogg demuxer will demux it and produce raw Theora frames. And so you go through the registry again, and you say, well, look, do you support Theora video? And eventually you get to Theora Deck. Theora Deck supports Theora. So you can automatically, you can get the system, well, you can either do this yourself to auto-plug everything, but there are actually elements, bins, that aggregate all that functionality inside them to automatically select all that stuff. So I mentioned buffers. Those are actually what actually contains the data, and they have caps describing what that data means. They flow downstream. They flow from source elements, such as a file source, all the way downstream to sync elements, such as an audio sync. That's the common case for Rhythmbox, for example. We also have events. Those travel in both directions, downstream and up. End of stream, seeking, tag messages for tag events for metadata, quality of service events. So those can travel both from the sources towards the sinks, such as an EOS, or they can travel from the sinks up towards the sources. Quality of service events are an example of that. They always flow across the pads. There's no way for elements to communicate with other elements except by going through the pads. The GST bus is the main way that the elements and the pipeline communicate with your application. When your application wants to do things with the pipeline, it just calls things directly. That's function calls. But sometimes things happen in the media playback pipeline, and the pipeline wants to communicate with your application. GStreamer uses threads for all of this. So normally, when you start, say, playing back a file, it will go off and spawn threads to do this, an appropriate number, depending on exactly what you're doing. As those of you who have done threaded programming know, that's not a lot of fun. So we have the GST bus, which will marshal anything that happens in those threads into the main thread so that your application can deal with it without worrying about those threads. So what can we do with these things, these building blocks? Well, there are lots of individual elements, individual plugins containing all sorts of elements. There are ones for encoding, Vorbasync, Fioroank, decoding, similarly, muxing, ogmux, demuxing, ogdemux. Wearing my other hat, when I'm not working on GStreamer, I like to do stuff with ziff.org. So I like to talk about free codecs like Theora and Vorbis. GStreamer is codec agnostic, and you can use anything with it. But that's why I like to use those as examples. Sources, syncs. Sources such as file source or ulsa source to read from a sound card. Syncs such as ximagesync to output an image to an X server, or ulsa sync or file sync. Then GStreamer also includes higher level functionality encapsulated into bins. A really nice example is decodebin. Decodebin is what does the auto plugging I was talking about for playback. It will auto plug a type finder to figure out what a data stream of some sort contains. Then it will auto plug a demuxer if necessary, and then a decoder. So that lets the application developer, if you're developing a player, not have to worry about any of the any of the details of what particular format is in use. Playbin goes a level higher. It will auto plug a source, so you can give it a URL, an HTTP URL, a file URL, RTSP, anything at all, and it will auto plug a source to read from that URL. It internally uses decodebin to go and decode that file, and then it auto plugs syncs, video syncs, audio syncs, whatever is appropriate. So the Totem movie player that GNOME ships uses playbin internally. There are also sort of mid-level bins. RTSP source is one example. That uses all of the low-level RTP elements and other low-level elements in GStreamer to read, to connect to an RTSP server and then set up an RTP sessions and read off the network for that. Another high-level bin is called gnonlin. I'm going to not talk about that one right now. I'll get to it towards the end of the talk. I said at the start that GStreamer wasn't an application. That's true, but we have little applications to help us as developers. Before I showed you GST Inspect, that's one of them. We have another one called GST Launch. And you can use that to experiment with different plugins in a fairly flexible sort of way. So here is an example where I use playbin, that top level element. And I set the URI property to this value. It's just a test file that I have.
The NASA ESA Hubble Space Telescope has captured a spectacular image of NGC 3603, a giant nebula hosting one of the most prominent...
So that's one... The GST Launch is a really powerful rapid prototyping tool. Here's another example. I use file source directly. This is an example where I'm not going to use any of those high-level bins. I'm going to write out a full GStreamer pipeline using the GST Launch tool. So I can read from this file. It's an odd file, so I can demux it. I'm going to decode the Theora data. Now, the Theora decoder outputs YUV data. That's very common. Most video codecs will output YUV data. My X server, on the other hand, only supports RGB. In fact, it supports YUV as well, using an extension to X called XV. But on this particular hardware, XV doesn't work on the external output, so I'm not going to use that. So we have this element called FFmpeg color space, which will convert between YUV, and RGB. The name is a historical oddity because the code internally to it originally, about four or so years ago, came from FFmpeg. And then I use XImageSync. And then something goes horribly wrong. So what went wrong there is that my particular sample file there had non-square pixels. My X server has square pixels, so I have to convert the non-square pixels to square pixels for display. So I use the video scale element for that. The exclamation marks are just the special syntax that GST Launch uses to connect different elements together. And there we have playback. Yeah, that's right. Yep. This gets a little bit more complex. We need a special element called Q to decouple the two sides of it. I give it a name. I'll just call it D.
The NASA ESA Hubble Space Telescope has captured
a spectacular image. So that's it working. Now I can go back and explain. So name equals D, that just sets the name property on that particular element. The Q property, whoops, that was slightly wrong and shouldn't have worked. Well, it was more a matter of luck. I actually need Qs on both branches to decouple the two branches properly. And then after that, on this side, it's just as it was, up to here. And then we can, normally what you have is an element name, a series of properties, and then an exclamation mark to say link to the next thing. Instead, we give an element class name. So here, the element class name is OgdyMux, but the actual element name, that particular instance of it, is called D. So I use the element name D and then a dot, and that refers back to that previously named element called D and says, feed one of the other outputs through this part. And it automatically, GStreamer automatically figures out that the Theora should go through this part and the Vorbis should go through this part, because if it tried to do it the other way around, it wouldn't work. Not quite. So if I show the pad, if I do GST inspect OgdyMux, it has one sync pad because data comes in on the sync pad. That's the raw encoded audio, encoded data. And then it outputs the audio and the video separately. It has what's called a sometimes pad. A sometimes pad is one that isn't always there. So I described that slightly wrongly. These are not actually pads that it's printing out here. These are what we call pad templates. Where availability is always, which is what the examples were before, there's a one-to-one correspondence between the pad template and the pad. A sometimes element has a one-to some number correspondence. So this pad template corresponds to zero or more actual pads. One gets created for every stream in the file. So if I had multiple sound cards, for example. So I'll run GST inspect on UltraSync. And UltraSync has a property called device. So if I had that, I could just say UltraSync device equals HW1:0 or something like that, using an also device string. I don't, so I'm not going to demonstrate that. So you can write a lot of different applications with GStreamer. Players, there are some examples. Encoders, servers. FluMotion is a streaming media server that I work on at Fluendo. and video and audio editors. PTV, Jacosha. Basically, the idea is that you can do anything you want with multimedia. I'm going to skip that one. Yes? So the question is about the real-time capabilities of GStreamer. It's very highly dependent on the particular elements involved. It's not hard real-time, but in practice, it's pretty good for soft real-time. But there are some elements that you just need to avoid because they're not designed for that. I don't think we get quite that low. Probably 5 milliseconds is more realistic. I haven't done any testing in that for a long time. So I'm going to give you some examples of some of the more advanced tricks that you can do with GStreamer. GStreamer provides this thing called a GST clock. That's a sort of abstract API for doing anything to do with synchronization and timing. When you have a timestamp on some bit of audio that says, play this back at 1 second, and a bit of video that says, play this back at 1.02 seconds, the syncs use that to figure out exactly when to play that back. The pipeline will automatically select the appropriate clock to use. So if you're playing back audio, it will use a clock based on the actual audio device. If you're not playing back audio, typically it'll be based on the system clock of the system. But you can force it to use a particular other clock. One example of another clock that you might want to use is this thing called GST Net Client Clock. It provides a clock based on information coming over the network from a GST Net Time Provider. So on the client side, here's a bit of code. We create the clock here, and we set it up, and we set the pipeline to use that particular clock, and then we set it to playing. I'm not going to talk too much about the details here. Instead, I'll show you a little demo. Yeah. So we're running a bit late. This is a nice little demo that I'm not going to have time to do. Basically, the idea is I run this little program, and I get the people I asked earlier to hold up their laptops, run one little command that's about 20 lines of Python code, and we do synchronized network playback across 10 different laptops in the audience. Really nice if I had time to do it. Right here, except replace IP with my IP, which I gave to you before. While he gets that set up,
I'm going to show you another demo. This is the Hubblecast. News and images from the NASA ESA Hubble Space Telescope. Traveling through time and space with our host, Dr. J, a.k.a. Dr. Joe Liska.
Here we have one.
Today, we are going to travel to the heart of
audio and video synchronized over the network.
That lies deep inside a vast nebula of gas and dust.
Do you want me to...
The nebula is called NGC 3603,
run.
And it is located about 20,000 light years from Earth in the Carina spiral arm of our own Milky Way galaxy. Now, it turns out that the nebula is actually the nursery of the star cluster. It is thought that the nebula contains hundreds of stars.
So to show another quick demo,
The NASA ESA Hubble Space Telescope has captured a spectacular image of NGC 3603.
This is the same file.
A giant
using a little program
hosting
called
one of the most prominent massive young clusters in the Milky Way. This
is a bit boring.
Location.
So let's speed him up a bit. Now, did everyone catch that? Because if you didn't, we can go backwards through it as well. Oops. I think my computer's a bit too slow to do triple rate backwards playback. Sorry? That particular file is Theora and Vorbis. There are people working on forwards playback at whatever playback rate you want works fine with any format. Backwards playback requires format-specific support. There are people working on it at the moment, but I haven't. It wasn't done. Wasn't working well enough 2 weeks ago, so I haven't really got that. I didn't want to demo it. Not quite sure I caught the question. Could you say it? Yeah. Right. GStreamer, the exposed as properties on the elements. You can, in all cases, yes. There's also some elements support a glib interface on the properties called GST controller that allows you to do things like say, I want the alpha on, I want this element to set the alpha channel to this value at time zero and this value at time 15 seconds and do a B spline between them or something like that. That's only supported for a small range of elements and properties at the moment, but it's designed to be easy to add. So I'm apparently out of time, and I'm going to take a few more questions instead.
We've got 5 minutes left, which we can do for questions, or if you wanted to wrap, if you had anything else you wanted to say, or if you finished.
Questions?
Questions?
Ah, gstreamer.freedesktop.org. That's one I should have put in the presentation. The question was, can we synchronize the video playback to the display refresh? I'm not sure if there's any support for that in X. There is support for that in OpenGL, for example. There's a video sync called GL Image Sync, which I believe uses that if it's available, or can use that if it's available. Again, that's one of those things where the framework can certainly let you do it, but it's a matter of whether the individual plugin that you're interested in does that. I haven't looked into it, really. So all I can say is, yes, in theory it's possible, and I think GL Image Sync supports it. Okay. So gnonlin is a set of plugins for essentially for writing nonlinear editors using GStreamer. The two reasonably well-known things that use it are a video editor called Pitavi and a multi-track audio editor called Jokosha. Both of them are pretty alpha. Not necessarily ready for, definitely not ready for production use. But the underlying functionality in GStreamer is pretty complete. So the GNL composition is an element. It's a GStreamer element. It's actually a bin, which lets you insert other elements in it called GNL sources. Oops. And say do things like say play 10 seconds from this file at time 0 to time 5, which will do that part at double speed, And then play 7 seconds of this other file at an offset of 20 seconds into the file, things like that. So that's the very brief overview. Jakosha you can actually use. The guys that work on it are not really programmers. They're primarily musicians and people who care about usability. So although it has some, it's not 100% complete, but it's what is there is well documented and is designed to be very usable. Pitavi, I tried to use it to set up a demo and I couldn't really figure out how to. Questions? Is hardware acceleration possible? This is another thing, it depends on the elements involved. If I go over here, actually I'll go back a few versions. So if I replaced XImageSync with XVImageSync, then this is actually displaying really nicely on my laptop, but it's actually a hardware deficiency. The hardware that accelerates that doesn't work on the external output. There's also people working on using OpenGL shaders for accelerating pretty much anything you want, accelerating conversion through color spaces, possibly in the future doing video codecs in GPU shaders, things like that. It's certainly possible. It's being used on real consumer devices. The N800 and N810 and N770 all use hardware accelerated decoders. Yeah, to some degree, yes. But I mean, obviously, implementing those is very platform dependent. But if you look at it at the higher level of I just want to write an application, I'm going to use Playbin to do playback. Well, Playbin doesn't actually handle that case. A newer version called Playbin 2, which has a slightly different API, does. It will automatically use hardware accelerated decoders and syncs where they're available. Anyone else? Because I think we're just about out of time. Yeah.